So what's the plan? That's what we want. Most of that plan, I think, is a very project. We're building an office at 50-day. Technology prototype for future asset improvements. And I'll also just say a few things in sort of in general sort of remarks about asset in general and kind of where we'd like to be going. So I should say, so the ideas in this particularly come from discussions with lots and lots of people, particularly obviously with the CBI group that Keith Duggan's going in Oxford. And there's this kind of, I guess, sort of Reese Collective at the moment. Thinking about something which comes under the general heading of SN interferometer, SNI. So Sarah Church at Stanford is kind of the coordinator of the discussions on this. On this topic, and a few years ago, when Angela and Sarah and I sat down and sort of first talked about this, we thought this project needed a title, and the title we came up with was CLANGR, which kind of stands for Cluster Angular Resolution, but it also means something else in particular if you were watching TV in Britain in the 1970s. And Sarah's now gone off this thing because she thinks the Americans don't understand this. But if you don't know, if you don't, if well, that would be a good acronym too. So if you don't know what clangers are, then you really should. I will explain gubbins at the appropriate time. Okay. Interferometry for SED and CMB is, of course, now a very well-established way of going about things, and there have been lots of experiments. I think it's just worth pointing out some of the nice features of doing doing interferometry on CMB. First of all, interferometers are a very natural way of rejecting the kind of time-varying atmospheric signal, which is the bane of all the total power instruments and all those people who've been reporting on those kind of experiments this week. The interferometer both resolves out the DC level and hence its time variations, and also even when there is correlated signal, it tends to, which is in principle detectable by the interferometer, it tends to be modulated at a different rate, and so can be got rid of from your real data. There are no scan synchronous signals because you don't scan; you just stare at the objects that you want to image and measure the Fourier modes from all your various baselines. There is a natural modulation of the signal, which comes from the fact that the Earth rotating modulates the phase of the visibilities that you measure, which allows you basically to do a kind of lock-in detection of the sky signal and reject all kinds of things in your data which are not modulated at the right frequency. It's relatively easy to change the resolution of the system by scaling the antenna spacings. And even antenna diameters. And there have been several CMB experiments which have, as CBI2, which we heard about earlier, as an example, where you change both the baseline and the antenna size to change the angular scale that you look at whilst maintaining sensitivity. It's a very natural way to measure polarization. If your antennas are sensitive to circular polarization, then you very nicely make the when you cross-correlate opposite hand circulars, you generate the Q and U signals independently of the T signal, which means you don't have the differencing of large numbers issue that you get from direct detection of linear polarization. You do generally get the thermal sensitivity that you wrote in your proposal. Because it depends how much you cheat. All these different sort of modulation schemes that you get do a very good job at rejecting
rejecting the non-thermal noise, all the various nasty components in your data.
Well, if you correlate linear polarizations, then you get the Qs and Us mixed up with the I's when you. So it's more difficult to say if as is typical, your I is much bigger than your Q and U, then you then have to difference the correlations of linear polarizations to separate I from Q and U. The nice thing about correlating circulars is that you get T or I. By itself, until V is typically zero anyway, and then you get the combinations Q and U automatically separated from R.
Circular polarization is only smaller, the majority of objects is smaller.
Oh, yes, the V Stokes parameter from the start is zero. But I say this is the only thing, but by actually making your antenna sensitive to circular polarization and correlating the two circular polarizations, you generate the intensity of the linear polarizations in your output. If you correlate linear polarizations, then you get combinations of I and Q and I and U.
People keep asking me this. What are the actual limits on circular polarization and stuff? Because nobody actually builds an instrument that's very sensitive to it.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, there are natural ways of generating V, but it's quite hard. You need, because obviously to get V, you have to have two orthogonal circular orthogonal linear polarizations with a coherent phase difference between them. It's really hard to think of any natural mechanism that will do that.
So we're looking down the barrel of a laser.
Mm-hmm.
They're very circular
polarization
in each
end.
It's
not
the quarter of a percent.
Yeah. If you do have large-scale coherent magnetic fields present in your source, then you can do it. But it's quite hard. as I said, there'll be lots of. Obviously, it's going to be in front. I thought I'd just put up a sort of gallery of mostly older experiments for the benefit of the young people in the audience. just to say, there were things before SLA. Full prize to anyone who can give the full bibliographic reference for each of these pictures. There were images of the SLA effect way back in the early 90s, and images of the CMB fluctuations too, not long after COVID, and basically interferons have done a lot of things. The imaging, power spectrum measurements, the burst detection of polarization in CMB, and so on. But as it's been remarked before, as was what I've just said about the general cleanness of interferometry for getting nice. Good quality data that's not full of nasty systematic effects, but you do have to incorporate all the or as many as you can of the correct elements of an interferometer to actually get the benefit of this. And so, what our periodically called proper interferometry does actually require that you do various things, which sometimes get left out in current interferometers that people talk about. First of all, any kind of interferometer will be a displaceable filtering job for you. That's what interferometers do. If you do what most interferometers do and down-convert the signal at the antenna, that has done a few nice things. First of all, allows you to put a phase modulation into the signal, and the usual way of doing that is by phase modulating the local oscillator, which you use to do the down conversion. And again, that allows you to do phase sensitive detection post correlation and gives you a very nice modulation scheme in which any funnies introduced in your electronics after the down conversion will tend to get switched out at that point. The general correlation receiver architecture is in general insensitive to amplifier one RF noise to first order. This was actually pointed out by Martin Ryle in the 1950s. He actually did his phase switching by switching in length of cable rather than switching both oscillators, but it's one of the nice things that the question, what is the one of reference of your amplifier, is rarely asked by people doing anything in front of you. It's one of those nice things that you can just forget about. Since you've got gain before you split your signal off to go to various correlations, you can make arbitrary numbers of baselines out of any given antenna. It's a really nice thing. And is in contrast to our optical interferometry colleagues who can't amplify their photons, and therefore they've only got a finite number of photons to divide up between however many baselines that they've got. Certainly the optical interferometry people know this. Occasionally the issue of what's also called volumetric interferometry comes up, and this is a real killer for it, is that if you're at frequencies where the photon occupation number of your system is low, so that you have shot noise dominated things, you can't amplify without amplifying your shot noise, and therefore you can't really do interferometry of the classic kind. The other, certainly I would say, desirable property of interferometer is to have tracking antennas. Not all interferometers do this. CBI doesn't, Daisy didn't. But the nice thing, although it requires you to have some means of then of equalizing the paths, so if you've got antennas which are individually mounted and track like this, then the path between the antenna and the sky changes and you have to compensate for that. But the fact that you generally insert that path in the intermediate frequency means that the phase, the path is right, the phase isn't. And so the phase is continuously changing, but in a completely predictable way. And that gives you your fringe rate signal that you can track on. And that's a very nice way of getting rid of things both in the sky, away from the direction you're pointing, and in the electronics. So if we were thinking about another interferometer in the future, what kind of things might we want it to do? Well, clearly there's all these great surveys going on at the moment. Until fairly recently, we were promised thousands or tens of thousands of clusters. Now, hundreds of the numbers, which we're talking about, a few thousands.
I said a couple hundred already in fiber data that's in hand right now. And it's not tens of thousands, but that's largely due to just the signal.
Sure. But the good thing is there will be lots of, we hope there will be lots of things to go and look at from these.
You will be able to learn the spectrum X with the Rosetta in Russia. Mm-hmm. I'm very afraid of delays with international describing. But it's still scheduled for the beginning of May of 2004. If everything occurs and estimates which should have the beginning made for me, irresident will be able to detect observe of 150,000 platforms in blue from the sky. Mm-hmm. And first it will be possible to correlate with SPT and ARC images in that region. It's equivalent of the 2,000 degrees. This will be of the order of 7,000 clusters and groups, because it will be possible to do richest objects. And it will be possible to go to follow up, not for 100,000, but you will get map with 150,000 objects.
That's good news, because that means we need to build follow-up instruments to look at these.
Which are able to do this very fast. Yeah. And it's also important, because time will be very short.
Yeah. Okay, so we want to look at all these objects, and once they've all been found, we will look at them in detail. We've been hearing lots of stuff this week. We need to look at the structure of these things and understand the gastrophysics of what goes on, both so that we can use clusters to do cosmology and because it's interesting in itself. And so we certainly need resolution. I mean, 30 arc seconds is probably the minimum we want better than that. We also
want resolution will be 13 arc seconds.
Right. We also want short baselines so that we see all the flux from clusters. The
zero baseline fluxes is the thing which tells us the total energy content of the cluster, which is an interesting thing to know. Ideally, we'd like sort of the full range of frequency coverage to separate out the foregrounds, including the CMB, look at kinetic asset, get the temperature from the relativistic corrections, even would be nice. And you certainly need a pretty broad frequency range if you're going to be able to separate out all these effects. And of course, we need lots of bandwidth, ideally up to the whole atmospheric windows that are available. Interferometers naturally need some frequency resolution anyway in order to function. The rule of thumb is that your fractional bandwidth, so at least in one channel, is of order of the ratio of the resolution to field of view. Otherwise, you get white smearing, effectively. But that means that frequency resolution is available to actually do science as well. Foreground diffraction, particularly having the frequency resolution so that the signal either side of the null doesn't just average to zero, but you can separate it out. And of course, Rashid's favourite topic, line emission.
Spectral lines and the world polarization also.
Okay, so this ideal range, going from the microwave to the millimeter, is a pretty broad range, and it spans basically two technologies. Of course, there's the Hemp amplifiers that are largely used at lower frequencies. The best performance now is alleged to be somewhere around five times the quantum limit. So this is an amplifier we bought recently off Sandy Weinreb, which is an extremely good amplifier, not playing at all. Which this line here is 10 times the quantum limit. This is the noise performance. So that's kind of where we are. Although it's predicted that in the near future, with new processes coming in, that this number is going to drop down to maybe three times the quantum limit in a few years' time. But also, SIS mixers, which are what ALMA uses, are extremely competitive at frequencies of certainly 100 gigahertz and upwards, and they already get within a small factor of the quantum limit. This is actually the simulated performance of a mixer I'm going to talk about in a moment, which we hope to achieve this in practice, which is better than two times the quantum limit. And we're using SIS mixers, then followed up by Hemp amplifiers, which are going to operate at 5 to 10 times lower frequency in the IF, then you certainly have possibilities of receiver temperatures in the low tens of kelvins at 200-ish gigahertz. You've then got to be able to correlate these signals. You certainly need many tens of gigahertz of bandwidth to get best of sensitivity. Now, you can imagine doing that in some kind of digital correlator. There's a lot of effort going into digital technology at the moment, particularly in the context of the SKA. The current state of the art is probably represented by this called the Roach, which is being developed by the South African SKA group and the Berkeley Casper group. And that gives you about 350 giga operations per second for a few $1,000. If you work out what you would want for, let's say, 100 baselines of 40 gigahertz bandwidth, you still need quite a lot of these, and it's a lot of money and a lot of power to run that. If you build your own devices, then you can certainly get automatically better performance than this, but the amount of effort you have to put into the design of that and the minimum quantities you have to order put this up into the sort of many millions of dollars league. Right. But obviously, more will rescue us eventually here.
So I know Eileen, who I guess here, started looking at this. GPU boards. So you can get $600 off the shelf that does 2 teraflops. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's maybe $200. But are those feasible?
People are looking at those as well. Whether you can actually get that performance in practice in a correlator is not at all clear. The limiting effect when you try and do these with these FPGA boards is tends to be more the IO bandwidth.
than the actual computing power. And the thing with GPUs is what they do is they take in a modest amount of data, do a lot of processing on it, and throw out a modest amount of data. And the correlator is actually a very simple thing. You don't need to do much processing per bit, but you get an awful lot of throughput. And that's the actual real killer with digital processing, you get the throughput. Analog correlators actually are what have been used for a lot of interferometers, CBI, DAISY, PSA. And I'll show you in a moment, there are available now, there are 20 gigahertz multiplier chips, which are not that expensive and don't consume that much power. And so certainly at the moment with this kind of technology, I'll say that analog is looking competitive, but Mr. Moore will catch up with us eventually. Okay, so I'm just going to talk briefly now about Gubbins itself. So Gubbins stands for the 220 gigahertz ultra broadband interferometer for SZ. And the remarkable thing, which you have to take my word for, is that we actually wrote down that phrase before realizing that it spelled Gubbins. So the phrase actually came before the acronym. And for those not familiar with the British English slang, it means a collection of not very useful bits and pieces. So the aim of this is to build a prototype millimeter wave heterodyne proper interferometer, proper in all the senses of the word, with modest spectral resolution, actually extremely limited spatial resolutions, it's only on one baseline, but high bright sensitivity, and to demonstrate some technologies that would be relevant to building a bigger instrument. And we got some money from the Royal Society to do this. Eventually we want to take it to the Atacama. We may take it to Tenerife first, which is rather easier to get to from the UK, although it's not as good a site. And if we're very lucky, we'll actually get to measure the SZ effect in a couple of the brightest clusters. That would be a very successful outcome if we have to do that. So this is what it looks like. And here are the specs. There's a single cryostat, called Ford. Two antennas here, two mirrors. I'll show you the actual optical layout and it's a bit clearer on some other pictures. But inside here we have two SIS mixers. Which feed these two antennas. It's tunable in this range, 185 to 275 gigahertz. Primary beam is going to be 11 arc minutes. In the first instance, the IF band you're going to get is 10 gigahertz wide. This is actually limited by the IF amplifiers we have available, but better IF amplifiers will come along. And it's a double sideband system, so we actually get this twice. So we get 20 gigahertz of bandwidth in one go. And we split each of those, we split the 20 gigahertz potential IF band, which we're not using all of, into 16 channels. And we're hoping to get an all-up system temperature of around 50K, which gives us a bright sensitivity, NET, in the hundreds of micro K root second, which is respectable. So the optical arrangement is built around the fact that we wanted to build tracking antennas but around a single cryostat. So what we end up with is here's the inside of the cryostat with the jacket removed. Here are our two SIS mixers. The local oscillator signal is beamed in through these windows into these horns. The RF signal comes in from these offset parabolic primary mirrors off these corner mirrors, which are actually convex diverging mirrors to help us get the beam through the window. This is a bearing about which these arms rotate. So there's the two axes of rotation of tracking come from one from rotation about this, and one from rotation about a bearing which is behind the mirror. Um,
So we're putting all together at the moment. Here are the mirrors. They're 400 millimeters projected diameter, machined in our workshops. Very nice, high accuracy. Here are those convex corner mirrors that, that fold the signals, fold beams round. Because this is a test system, the mirrors are actually mounted on these slightly expensive commercial sort of goniometer mounts, which means we have micrometers and bearings, so that it can all be aligned in a way that you wouldn't want to do on a large system. The mixers, they're niobium SIS mixers. Niobium has a transition temperature around 7 Kelvin, so you need to run about 4 Kelvin. So we don't want to be messing around with liquid cryogens. So we have a mechanical cooler, it's a Giffen-McMahon cooler. Gives us a watt of cooling at 4 Kelvin, which is plenty for this. Here it is. Here's the first stage and second stage of the GM cooler. Here's the cold plate on which the mixed blocks are going to sit. And here's the cryostat jacket with the RF windows here and the LO windows here. So the mixers for this are rather special, as SIS mixers go. So the intention is to get as much IF bandwidth out of these as possible. Typical IF bandwidths for SIS mixers in the past have been a few gigahertz. Obviously, the ALMA ones support the 8 gigahertz bandwidth. We wanted to get well over 20. These have been designed by Paul Grimes in Oxford and fabricated in the Cologne facility with Carl Jacobs. And this is what one of the chips looks like. This is about 5 millimeters from end to end. This is a thin line structure. If you've not seen one of these before, it slots into a waveguide. And these two metallized fins here collect the waveguide mode, the field lines going like this, gather them into a strip line mode, which then runs along here. Then you have various circuit filtering elements in the strip line. And then finally you get to the little 1 micron square, which is the mixer itself. And just as an aside, it's nothing to do with Gubbins, but this is exactly the same thin line design as would have been used in the, or may yet still be used, but at the moment is not being used in the Clover CMB polarization experiment, where you have a thin line structure going into a strip line, and in this case ending up on a TES rather than an SIS mixer. And these chips were designed by Paul, again in Oxford, and the TSs and the fabrication here done by Stafford Withington's group in Cambridge. As you can see, there are whole wafers of them. Okay, back to the Gubbins mixer. So basically the trick is to put the appropriate filtering and tuning circuits into the strip line so that you get the IF band out. You don't get the IF coupling to the RF side, and having it all matched over the full bandwidth that you want. And so this is all predictions, but these say the first of these mixers have actually been fabricated, and they seem to work pretty much as designed. The predicted noise temperature is about 20 Kelvin over the full IF and RF band. So these have been cooled down and measured. We've got a temperature of about 50 Kelvin at the moment, but with known problems to do with absorption of the cryostat windows and LO power problems. So we're pretty confident that these mixers will actually perform as planned down to this noise level. And by the magic of quantum mechanics, you actually get conversion gain out of these things. The conversion gain varies between about +3 and -3 dBs across the band. The mixer sits in this block. If you're not into SIS mixers, the block is almost a significant part of the technology as the chip itself. And the job here is these are waveguide. Waveguide is machined into the block, and you drop a lid on to complete the waveguide. And the RF and the LO are fed in three separate waveguides. And then this, these little strips, which are fabricated on separate quartz chips and dropped into slots in the waveguide, couple the LO signal across from the LO side into the RF side, give you the mixing. And obviously, we want to phase switch our signals to get the phase switch correlation receiver. And we do that by using a the LO source is a times 18 multiplier. That we, so we feed in a signal around 12 gigahertz and get out our 200 gigahertz LO. And because it's a times 18 multiplier, if we put a 10 degree phase switch into the input signal, then we get 180 degrees phase switching out of the multiplier end. So once we've got our 20 gigahertz signal coming out, I'll say it's limited to 3 to 13 at the moment by these first IF amplifiers. We have a whole chain of 20 gigahertz bandwidth warm IF electronics. We have amplifiers here that we've developed, which work nicely over these frequency range. And this is the one of the bits that allows you to do proper interferometry. So this is the path compensator. So these devices are FET switches. So a signal comes in through here, and depending which way you set the switch, you either send the signal via a short path or a long path, and that compensates for the geometric delay introduced by the pointing of the telescope. Then we get to the correlator. So this is an analog 16 lag complex correlator looking at this bandwidth. So the signals are split into in phase and quadrature to give us the sine and cosine correlation terms. And then each side we have the signal split 16 ways, signal from the other antenna, likewise split 16 ways, and then where the signals come together, you correlate, and then you take the outputs from these and do a Fourier transform to transform from lag space to frequency space. This has been developed with a lot of work from Christian Holler in Oxford. The actual multiplier chips here were developed by Andy Harris from Maryland with an industrial collaborator, Steve Maas. These were originally built for the WASP family of autocorrelation spectrometers. So we're using them here as a cross-correlator, which they work fine. And so these are the actual. These are the first prototype boards that we've had fabricated. This is the complicated bit. This is the 16-way splitter tree, which has to be nicely matched across generating all these signals. And then here is the chip itself bonded across to the lines. And then the output signal goes through these pins and out the back of the board into a whole lot of readout electronics. And that's all being tested on the bench. And all seems to work very well. We have a nice response across the whole 20 gigahertz. And particularly with an analog system, the tricky thing is to get the actual spacing between the lags even. Otherwise, it makes it very difficult to calibrate your Fourier transform and get good data out of the Fourier transform spectrometer and the scatter. In the lags we get is less than 10%, which is manageable. Yes, absolutely, yeah. So, provided the errors are a fairly small fraction, and you do the calibration, then you get the invertible matrix, and you can deal with it. So the status, it's all coming together at the moment. We've got mixers have been tested, the correlator has been tested. We've built a lot of the IF components, and the whole system is sort of mechanically being put together. And if it all works according to plan, this is the kind of sensitivity we might hope to get from for a bright cluster. We do kind of ask ourselves every so often, why are we measuring this SZ signal near the null? It's a really stupid thing to do. The signal's really small. Wouldn't it be better to do this at 100 gigahertz? But anyway, if it works, it's the hardest test. So it, So here are some. yeah, try and measure zero, and if you can measure it, you've done really well. Yeah. So here are some SZ spectra, actually, so as a function of electron temperature. So you're seeing the relativistic effect here, and this is each one of these sort of blocks is one separate tuning of the system. So we've got, and we've binned the data into two lower sideband and two upper sideband bins for each tuning. And yeah, given that we're going through the null here, we should be able to measure the spectrum at this kind of level. I'm not going to claim that we're going to actually distinguish between relativistic spectra at this level, but if we get this thermal performance, we'll be very pleased. Red, no, red is low. The zero crossing frequency goes up with temperature. If you can separate it out from the kinetic effect and all the other contaminants, then in principle, yes. Yeah. That's one of the goals. I mean, if you have this and you have some measurements at lower frequency and probably at higher frequency as well, and I say in particular, if you can separate, I mean, this chunk. I mean, this would all come out as one number from a 220 gigakilometer. And would average nicely to zero, but given we have got some frequency resolution in this band, then yeah, that would be the plan. Measure the temperatures directly from the shape of the spectrum. Yeah. I mean I think it's a beta model with sensible parameters for, you know, it's 0.16 plus 16 or something like that. So a nice big fat cluster. Oh, right. Right. Good question. Well, the more components you put into the input, the more frequencies you're going to need to separate them all out. So, sure. Yeah. And I think it makes the biggest difference way up in the increment regime.
It's basically you scale it all the way down, so in the ultra relativistic limit, it's the negative of the Planckian spectrum. But if you have a transrelativistic population or something, then it's something in between.
Right.
So, you know, some interpolation, basically.
We definitely haven't tried to model whether that's separable, this kind of data, yet. Okay, so finally, assuming the eagle is worked, I mean, should we be bothering? I mean, can an interferometer compete with these big Blanc arrays? I think the answer is for point observations, yes. I mean, as we see, the big Blanc arrays are great ways of doing surveys. When you're
interested in looking at a relatively small cluster. Of course, most of your blanks are not looking at the cluster; they're looking over here somewhere. Unless you do what Brian was talking about and just build a really really big telescope, in which case this whole pattern scales down, and you get lots and lots of blanks on this patch. But just sort of throwing in some random numbers, if you take this kind of arrangement, the same way you've got about, I don't know, 25 beams of the cluster. And you work out a figure of merit for this, which is based on your LET per kilometer, the number of beams pointing at the cluster, and the fraction of the sky that you're covering, so your sort of number of dither patterns that you need to do. You get up with a sort of figure of merit, which is around a few hundred micro-k root second. The equivalent figure of merit for your interferometer would be the NET of the detectors divided by the filling factor, the fraction of the aperture which is actually collecting photons, which is it's basically, you know, the ratio of the dish diameter to the baseline squared times the number of antennas you've got. And if you try really hard and make a really, really close factor array, you might push that up towards a half or something. And so for the kind of numbers we're talking about, yeah, you get similar kind of numbers. So it's certainly it's competitive in terms of you know, a sort of raw sensitivity calculation. And the other thing is, I think in if you achieve these numbers, you will achieve this number. We know that the the interferometers that we've built are thermal noise limited. We're not going to get killed by array scanning effects and atmospheric RF noise and all those things, which will only tend to push this one up. And there's another trick you can do with interferometers if you're thinking about building a big one and you don't have infinite money, which is to say, right, we want to fill a big aperture with a high filling factor, but we don't really want to build a correlator for that number squared of baselines. So you can do pretty much as well if you have an array of small antennas in the middle, and then as you get out to bigger baselines, you make bigger antennas. Your field of view goes down, which you may be able to live with anyway, or you may put multiple feeds per big dish. But that's only going to give you another an n scaling in your correlator size. And just with making up some random numbers, you see that you easily save an order of magnitude in your correlator size. So this is a potentially good way to go. And of course, I mean, this kind of thing has been done before, SZA Karma ends up looking not so different from that. Sarah Church have done some simulations on this kind of thing, and you end up getting pretty nice maps. Okay, so summary: interferometers, I think, are a great way to do pointed SZ imaging. You can certainly get, in principle, the range of high and low resolutions that you'd like. But ALMA, as we were saying earlier, will give you the very high res end, and there's no point trying to build ALMA again. But ALMA has a low spatial frequency cutoff, and there's certainly a niche for an instrument that has similar frequency coverage to ALMA, certainly in the 30 to a few hundred gigahertz range, but fills in those short spacings where all the SZ signal really is. The HEMT and SIS front end technologies will give us competitive noise temperature and bandwidth to kilometers, and we can already build analog correlators that are not necessarily expensive to give us the kind of correlator bandwidth that we need. And the digital correlators will catch up. They're relatively expensive at the moment, but undoubtedly, give it a decade or so, and we'll be wanting to build digital correlators. And we're building Gubbins to provide a test bed for some of these technologies. And so I think a really good SZ survey fault instrument with wide spectral coverage and a big angular scale range is certainly technically completely feasible. And the only problem is the usual one. Okay, thank you.
So the n scaling is recipe for everything.
Yeah.
So
if you don't correlate everything, then you just lose sensitivity. Just in proportion to all the baselines that you don't make. So you can just decide to do whatever fraction of those you like, but you'll lose sensitivity.
How good is like a 10 meter with a 1 meter baseline? I'm just picturing this, getting even more foveated.
Oh right. Well, you can train that off as you wish. I mean, in some ideal optimization, then every antenna gets slightly bigger the further out it goes. That would be silly. You quantize it in some.
sensible way. But a topic like, I don't know, kind of guessing that the sort of, you know, the 3-to-1 diameter, 10-to-1 in area is probably a sensible step to go in. Maybe a bit less.
And the your 500 microcarbon per second, that was for a single baseline?
That's for the array, if you like.
What was the array that went into that?
I didn't put a specific array into that. All I said was if every front end has a given NET, and you make an array which has a given filling factor, then you will make images which have that NET per pixel. The bigger you make your array, the bigger size image in pixels you'll be able to make with the same instantaneous sensitivity per pixel.
Any more questions? All right, well, thanks very much.